here with, it says in the papers, is Deirdre Purcell.
One of Ruan McCormack's reports from Gaza City makes the lead for the Irish Times this morning. In it, he describes as uneasy the calm that hung over Gaza City during a lull in the fighting, and writes about last night's telephone conversation between the US President and the Israeli Prime Minister, in which Barack Obama called for an immediate, unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. Today is the Muslim feast of Eid, marking the end of Ramadan, but there's little to celebrate, according to one woman to whom the reporter spoke. We haven't been able to buy anything. There's no Eid. People are visiting each other to offer condolences. That's it. Meanwhile, Israel claims its ground forces have uncovered more than 30 tunnels, some leading into Israeli territory. The propaganda war between both sides has involved social media sites and has now brought in European capitals, including the city of Dublin. This morning, for its lead, the Irish Sun prints the mocked-up Facebook images sent from Dublin's Israeli embassy, showing European icons and statuary dressed in the niqab. In Dublin's case, it's the Molly Malone statue. In Paris, it's the Mona Lisa. For Copenhagen, it's the Little Mermaid, and so on. They bear similar legends: Israel now, Dublin, or Paris or Copenhagen next. The Mona Lisa figure is carrying a rocket launcher. Barry Malone, who wrote the story, spoke to an Israeli embassy spokesman who confirmed that the images have now been taken down, but not because of any complaints. Often things get deleted for space reasons, he said. The Irish Independence front page carries the plea by Pope Francis to both sides in the crisis to end the bloodshed and to think of the children who are robbed of the hope of a dignified life, of a future, dead children, wounded children, mutilated children, orphans, children who, for toys, have the debris of war, children who do not know how to smile. But back home, for the Independence lead, Fionnán Sheehan tells us that according to draft government calculations, homeowners in Dublin and in other areas around the country, including Meath, Kildare, Wicklow, Kerry, Clare, Galway City and Cork City and County, can expect a full 15% cut in their property tax next year, while some other places can expect cuts of up to 15%. Sheehan writes that, without naming specifics, the Public Spending Minister Brendan Howlan has confirmed this. And The Independent covers more of what the ESRI has found in that report you heard about in the bulletin, that the dramatic drop in the number of higher earners during the economic crash has resulted in middle-income earners having to carry the bulk of income tax. In that context, The Times finds front-page space to highlight hints Minister Simon Coveney has given. While numbers are tight, he said, he expects middle and low-income earners would welcome certain tax changes in budgets 2015 and 2016, which would start the process of improving people's take-home pay. There'll be more about this latest ESRI report shortly in this programme. But for The Examiner, the main story this morning, written by Michael Clifford, is that certain products offered on bookies' premises in this country, such as virtual roulette, may not be covered by present licences and may therefore be illegal. Clifford writes that whereas the bookies say the activity is covered under betting because clients have to fill in slips when they pay, according to Revenue, the activity falls under the heading of gaming and could have implications for the renewal of licences. And finally, for now, the distinguished actor Ian McKellen has called for a living wage to be paid to actors, saying that just one actor in 50 earned over €25,000 annually. That's in The Sun.
Deirdre, thank you. Brian Finn is here with the business headlines.
Rachel, thank you. Ryanair has reported net profit of €197 million for its first quarter ending June 30th. That's up over 150% on the same period last year, but there's a slight distortion in that it included the busy Easter season this year, which fell into the prior year results in 2013. Nonetheless, it's a strong outcome and the airline is on course for a profit of €620 to €650 million for the full year. That's up from a previous range of €580 to €620 million and would be a very good outcome given that it reported its first drop in profits for 5 years last year. Passenger numbers in Q1 were up 4% at just over 23 million passengers. Revenue was up 11% at €1.34 million. The Dublin Chamber of Commerce is calling on the government to give business owners early access to a portion of their pension funds for the specific purpose of business growth. It calculates that up to €7.5 billion worth of SME financing could be unlocked if this idea was implemented. It forms part of the Chamber's budget submission. The Chamber said the government now needs to focus on non-banking financing solutions for SMEs. Staying with the enterprise theme, and anyone hoping to set up a business might consider going the co-op route in future, legislation comes into effect today, easing the regulatory burden on cooperative societies and making it easier to set one up and run one. The Minister for Enterprise, Richard Bruton, introduced reduced fees for the registration of cooperative societies about a year and a half ago. Among the changes today will be an extension of the examinership process to co-ops. Deutsche Bank, HSBC and Bank of Nova Scotia have been accused of attempting to rig the price of silver. A lawsuit has been filed in the US alleging that the banks, which set the price of silver every day, abuse their position in the market. The lawsuit follows similar accusations in the gold price-fixing market. Earlier this year, Barclays was fined £26 million after one of its traders was caught trying to fix the price of gold. Finally, a look at the currencies. The euro is trading at $1.34.3 and just above 79 pence sterling, Christopher.
Brian, thank you very much.
1 year after legislation was introduced to bring down the price of generic drugs, the cost of many medicines remains far higher here than in Britain. In fact, so significant is the difference that in many cases it would actually be cheaper for the HSE to buy the drugs from Britain's National Health Service. Susan Mitchell, who's the health correspondent of the Sunday Business Post, has been writing about this and she's with us this morning. Good morning.
Morning, Rachel.
Tell us about some of the price differences between here and the UK, because there are some quite staggering differences.
Some of them are absolutely colossal. You're right. We had one which is called, the generic name of this drug is olanzapine, and the original brand would be called Zyprexa, which is what a lot of patients would know it as. The British price is €2.65. The Irish price is €71.97. So it's just absolutely massive.
€2.65 versus €71.97. That's just extraordinary, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. Now, to be fair, that was the biggest variation we found, but many of the others were also huge. There was another psychiatric drug called Seroquel. The brand name, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it, but the Irish price is €34.80, or in other words, what the HSE is paying. The NHS is paying €2.90. And there were many, many other examples for a variety of different medicines, for medicines to treat breast cancer, statins, which are used by hundreds of thousands of patients. So these are adding up to an enormous amount of money for the state and the taxpayer.
For years, we were told that the wider use of generic drugs would be key to bringing down health costs. So why are the prices of these drugs so high?
I really cannot answer that. The HSE has brought down the prices. You know, they have the reference price, which they've now set for all of these medicines, and they've set prices for about 20 medicines over the past year, is certainly lower than what it was. But the differentials between here and the UK remain absolutely colossal. I don't know why that is. The HSE says they have to be cognizant of things like security of supply. We're a smaller market. I know that some people would, theorise that we have to keep big pharma in this country happy because they employ so many people. And a lot of other people dispute that because they say that nobody in pharma would expect variations of this magnitude and that it's more to do with incompetence than anything else. I really can't explain why the variations are so huge.
So what's being done then to try and tackle this problem?
Well, reference pricing was supposed to tackle this problem, and I think that's what is so disappointing about this, certainly from taxpayers' perspectives and indeed from patient groups, because reference pricing was supposed to bring our prices down and bring us into line with the rest of Europe. And that was what former Health Minister James Riley actually said. He said that under reference pricing, the times or the variations between here and the UK would end. Unfortunately, they haven't.
Have the pharmaceutical companies had anything to say about this?
Very little. They've said very little other than the fact that prices have come down, and indeed they have. They also would say that we're a much smaller market. And another important point, and I think that is a valid point, is that we've had a very, very small number, or competition in the generic market here in Ireland has been quite small. in the past, so there aren't as many companies competing for business. So that possibly is a factor. But as people suggested to me, why don't we bypass some of the generic companies here and go straight to the UK and buy our medicines from them?
And at the moment then, how is the price decided? Who does the deal for the state?
The HSC does this. So this is effectively what happens is the Irish Medicines Board groups a bunch of medicines in the same bracket. So these would all be off-patent and generic medicines. So if you take something like atorvastatin, the original brand was Lipitor. When that comes off-patent, the Irish Medicines Board bunches all of the various different atorvastatins in a particular group, and the HSC then goes in and sets what is called a reference price. And this reference price is the amount that the HSC will reimburse pharmacists for that medicine. If someone with a medical card wants the original branded product or a more expensive variation, they must pay the difference themselves. But this is what the HSC is paying.
You've been writing about this for several years now. Do you see that any attempt is being made to try and address the problem?
There is an attempt being made, but I feel it's inadequate. I don't think that anybody can even try to justify variations of this magnitude. I think there's something seriously wrong. And if the HSC is finding that pharma companies aren't playing ball, well, then it should come out and say this publicly, and arguably maybe look to bypass some of the smaller companies in this market and go direct to the UK and purchase our medicines there.
Susan Mitchell of the Sunday Business Post, thank you very much for joining us.
And early this morning, the United Nations Security Council called for an immediate and unconditional humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza to allow aid to reach civilians. The 15-member council released a statement shortly after midnight calling for the truce between Israel and Hamas. There was a ceasefire on Saturday, but efforts to continue that into Sunday appear to have faltered. The death toll in almost 3 weeks of fighting stands at around 1,030 Palestinians, mostly civilians, and around 45 Israelis, of whom 43 were soldiers. Ruan McCormack of the Irish Times yesterday was in Gaza, and earlier I spoke to him about the scene there after almost 20 days of bombardment from the Israeli military.
Well, Christopher, I drove in from Gaza's northern border with Israel yesterday through some of the areas that have seen the heaviest fighting in recent weeks. These areas are a wasteland. They're deserted. For the first 10 to 15 minutes of that drive, I saw no sign of life whatsoever. There are houses that have been razed. Those that are still standing are heavily pockmarked. There are large craters in the roads, and there's a strong smell of burning all around. The people who fled these areas are among 167,000 Gazans at the last count, who the UN says have been displaced by the conflict. Many of them are being housed in emergency UN shelters. Now, to give you a sense of the scale of that, 167,000 people is about one-tenth of the population of the entire Gaza Strip. Now, the picture is somewhat different in Gaza City Centre, where people feel it's a little bit safer to move around. Here, some shops were open yesterday. People were out on the streets, albeit nowhere near the numbers you might expect to see on an ordinary day. And when you speak to people, you get a strong sense that while they might be told there's a ceasefire, they're sceptical and nervous about being caught outside if and when the bombing resumes.
What about infrastructure? What were you able to determine about the water supply, for instance? And also, are there shortages in the shops?
The shops are reasonably well supplied. The bigger problem has been water outages here and there and electricity, which has been out in large parts of the Gaza Strip for more than a week now. I saw electricity workers trying to repair some of the lines near the buffer zone with Israel yesterday, but they were clearly very nervous to be out that far, and I'm not sure whether they managed to repair the lines. It was relatively quiet here overnight, and while I've seen reports this morning of a rocket hitting open ground near Ashkelon in southern Israel, from where I am, that calm has continued into this morning. Today's the beginning of Eid, the feast that marks the end of Ramadan. So a lot of people have been out to the mosque. I can see three or four fishermen in the water near the harbour. That's something you wouldn't have seen last week. It appears that there's no formal ceasefire agreed by both sides and brokered by third parties. But from here, it does seem that there's some sort of a tacit truce for now. If you don't shoot, we don't shoot, that sort of thing. But the situation is clearly very fluid and it can change by the hour.
What's your assessment as to whether or not that the current situation, the fact that nobody is firing rockets or shelling in great quantities at the moment, what's your assessment as to whether or not that can be built on and that, in fact, as the UN hopes, we can have a truce?
It's very difficult to say. The big news here last night was that the White House released an account of a phone call between Barack Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister. During that call, we're told, President Obama said he wanted an immediate, unconditional humanitarian ceasefire. That was the first time he'd said that, and it suggests that Washington may be running out of patience here. And this morning, we hear that the UN Security Council has passed a resolution in very similar language. The tension between Israel and the US has been building for a few days since the apparent rejection by Israel of that ceasefire proposal tabled by John Kerry. The Israeli press was full yesterday of criticism of John Kerry over that proposal. The Israelis said it was too close to Hamas's positions and that it didn't take adequate account of Israel's security needs, which in effect means that it didn't include anything about the demilitarization, as Israel puts it, or the disarming of Gaza. The Americans were clearly put out by this and said the document was a draft that Kerry had sent to the Israelis for their input. Now, the upshot of all of this manoeuvring is that the bombardment and the rockets have abated for now, but demands of each side are still quite far apart and there's no formal truce. So the situation is fluid and liable to change by the hour.
If we look back to the conflict in 2008 into 2009, that lasted a little over 3 weeks. We are at, if you like, the three-week phase or the three-week point tomorrow and a little over that then into this week. Is there a sense that perhaps the desire to fight on both sides is running out of steam?
That could be true. One of the big issues is that Israel maintains that even if there is a cessation agreed between the two sides, that it wants to remain on the Gazan side of the border until such time as it has located and destroyed all of these tunnels, which it says the destruction of these tunnels linking Gaza and Israel is the main objective of its ground operation. So that's one of the big sticking points. The other is Israel's demand for some sort of a demilitarization of the Gaza Strip. And as I mentioned, it does seem that these demands on both sides are still quite far apart. Against that background, you have a very uncertain, fluid situation on the ground. If you take what we saw yesterday, when the day began with heavy exchanges of fire in the north and the east of the Strip, Israel had said it was observing a 24-hour truce, and that when Hamas continued to fire rockets, it resumed its raid by air, ground and sea. Then at 2 p.m., Hamas announced that it had accepted a request for a separate 24-hour humanitarian ceasefire to coincide with Eid. From where I was in Gaza, that ceasefire appeared to hold, at least for a few hours. Then again last night, there were reports of bombings and rockets before it fell silent and we had a relatively quiet night. You do sense that both sides are speaking at cross purposes. And for the people on the ground, it's extremely difficult to get a sense of what's going on. You speak to people who haven't left their homes in 2 or 3 weeks, and they say they're still reluctant to leave because even though they might be told there's a ceasefire, they're sceptical and nervous, and they're very concerned about being stuck outside if it starts again.
And that was Ruan McCormack of the Irish Times talking to us from Gaza earlier this morning. We'll have more on the conflict after 8 o'clock.
Darren Frehel joins us with the sport. Good morning to you, Darren.
And a very good morning to you as well, Rachel. Tipperary and Limerick have booked their places in the All-Ireland Hurling semi-finals. Tipperary overcame Dublin 223 to 16 points. John O'Dwyer scored 2 goals. 13 points between the sides in the end, so a disappointing exit for the Dubs. But Tipperary already looking forward to that big clash against their Munster rivals Cork on the 17th of August, the first time the two sides will ever have met at this stage of the competition in Croke Park. So it should be an amazing occasion, and Tip attacker Lark Horbert is relishing that challenge.
That was a very, very flat game there today. Dublin definitely won't be happy with themselves. It never came to championship intensity. Yeah. We never got there either. And that performance won't do in Croke Park. But I suppose on the positives, with subs come on there today, they played very, very well. The players like Mickey Kell, Conor Matty now chopping at the bit to get back in now for the next 3 weeks. And that's exactly what we want. We want the best 15 and we want the best panel going to Croke Park in 3 weeks' time.
Eamon O'Shea, after the Limerick defeat, believed in the panel, and it shows because you've won 3 successive championship matches now against Galway, Offaly, and this win against Dublin.
Well, I suppose Eamon O'Shea has always had belief in us, and that's where we get our belief from, because he's the leader, he's the boss, and he gives us as individuals and as a team together, he gives us great belief, and that's why we believe in the man, and we're only delighted to be representing him out there. And Tipperary there today.
And finally, Larry, you would have taken this about a month ago, an All-Ireland semi-final against Munster rivals, yeah, Cork.
We would have taken anything a month ago. as I said, like, you know, we were, our backs were to the wall, Limerick were after beating us, we weren't too sure where we were going to go, but Eamon O'Shea gave us the belief, and that's why we're here today, and we're only delighted to be representing Tipperary in 3 weeks time at Croke Park, and hopefully we can bring a performance with us.
Yeah, that's Lara Corbett, the one and only, speaking to Pat McAuliffe after the game yesterday. It really has been an amazing turnaround for Tipperary. Halfway through the league campaign, there was talk that they were going to be relegated, and they're 70 minutes away from an All-Ireland final.
I remember
final.
That. I remember, I suppose I would. Clare giving them a good thrashing in the league, and sure, look what happened.
A lot has happened
peaked
since then.
Too early.
The Wexford dream is over, Rachel. Limerick progressed to the last four of the championship thanks to a 4-26-1-11 victory. 24 points the difference in this one. Limerick scored 4-21 from play. Shane Dowling helped himself to 2-8. The Treaty County will play Kilkenny in the semi-finals on the 10th of August. Let's hear from their manager, TJ Ryan.
I think, to be fair to Wexford, playing 4 weeks in the trial at this level, this intensity is not, I don't think it's possible. Two lots of extra times, to be fair to them. Probably caught up with them today. Look, an awful lot took advantage. We had a couple of scores before half time, pushed on and made life a bit easier for ourselves.
And two wins in Thurles in the Championship in one season?
Yeah, it'd be great to play the All Ireland semi final here, like, but that's not going to happen. But look, from our point of view, we got a big job ahead of us now, you know what I'm saying? It's a good opportunity, as I said, from the outside. You know, I mean, we've got to go back to work and training the pitch now again. Huge challenge coming up in Kilkenny. But what a great challenge to be looking forward to this time of the year.
Yeah, two great games to look forward to next month. Dundalk moved 3 points clear at the top of the SSE or Tricity League Premier Division following a 5-1 win against Bray. Stephen Kenny, the manager, he his side have been one of the most consistent teams this season, but they have a big game coming up against Cork City later this week.
We're just focusing on winning matches. We've got to go to Cork this week. We're in very good form at the moment, and you know, I think the players are working extremely hard, showing a great attitude. The whole squad really applying themselves, and we're, you know, it's coincided with us being on a great run, and we want to try and continue that.
Sligo Rovers 2-1 winners against Limerick. Michael Duffy scored a hat-trick as Derry overcame UCD 6-1. Liverpool have completed the signing of Dejan Lovren from Southampton. It's reported that the defender has cost around €25 million. Manager Brendan Rodgers, though, has decided to pull the plug on the move for the French striker Loch Remy. It would appear there's an issue with his medical. In racing, the Galway races get underway at Ballybrit later this afternoon. The action gets underway at 5:10. The feature, the Connacht Hotel Handicap at 6:45. Dermot Weld has runners in all but one of the seven races as he starts off his bid to be crowned top trainer for the 28th time. The racecourse manager is John Maloney.
We did a survey there a couple of years ago, and it was worth €60 million then to the economy. That was probably in the height of the boom. It's probably worth someplace in the region between €50 and €60 million. Like, everybody gets a turn out of Galway. You know, all the whole restaurants, shops, petrol stations, no matter what you're selling, they'll get some bit of a lift out of race week. And it's great to see the amount of people that come to Galway and stay overnight or stay for a couple of nights. And even now with the motorways, people tend to commute, and you know, from the M15 out to the race course is just about 2 hours. So, like, you know, you can get in your car and you can be sure to be in the race course in Galway in just less than 2 hours.
Should be a great week. There's live coverage on RTE television today. In golf, Damien McGrain lost out to David Horsey in a playoff for the Russian Open. Both players finished on 13 under par. The Meathmen lost out on the first playoff hole. On the PGA Tour, Tim Clark took the honours at the Canadian Open thanks to a 17 under par total. Graham McDowell finished inside the top 10 on 9 under. Bernard Langer won the Senior Open Championship by 13 shots. Red Bull's Daniel Ricciardo took the honours at the Hungarian Grand Prix. He took the checkered flag ahead of Ferrari's Fernando Alonso. Lewis Hamilton in his Mercedes ended up third after starting the race from the pit lane. Nico Rosberg, the championship leader, was fourth. Finally, Vincenzo Nibali has been confirmed as the winner of the Tour de France. The Italian is the sixth man to win all three Grand Tours. He finished 7 minutes and 37 seconds ahead of his nearest challenger. Nicholas Roach was back in 39th place, almost 2 hours behind the eventual winner.
5 years after it closed, there's a new development in the fight by Waterford Crystal workers for their pensions. A trade union representing the workers has accepted an invitation to refer their pensions dispute to the Labour Relations Commission in the hope that a settlement can be reached. We're joined on the line from Waterford by the Regional Secretary of the Unite Trade Union, Jimmy Kelly. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, the background to this very briefly, when the Crystal factory closed, the loss of 1,500 jobs, workers discovered their pension scheme was insolvent. Subsequently, the European Court of Justice ruled the state here should step in and pay the pensions of some of those workers. So how come today the Labour Court has become involved or will be involved?
the beginning of this case, which was obviously the closure of Waterford Crystal, so an insolvent company and an insolvent pension fund. We took the long route in terms of the court process, eventually referred to the European courts, and we were successful in getting a ruling in our favour, which applies to all workers in the state. But we've since April 2013 been trying to get some speedy resolution to the case. It's in the court process and it's listed now for January of 2014. But we've spent a number of months engaging with the Department of the Tánaiste, Joan Burton, and we've now got agreement that Kieran Mulvey will be now looking at the case and trying to resolve and reach an agreed resolution. We had support along the way from a wide number of Oireachtas members, from the ICTU's David Begg. The financial implications of running a case like this is you won't get out of the starting blocks without putting €1 million on the table. We've had financial support from SIPTU. So widespread support, and over the past number of months, we've been trying to get a mechanism for resolving the dispute on the pensions. Ooh. And we see this now as a positive development. The court process in itself is very aloof. It's very detached from us. This gives us a way to engage. I've already been engaging with Kieran Mulvey, and he's looking forward to getting to a stage where we can have an agreed settlement and agreed resolution of the dispute.
As you understand it, what was the government's difficulty in stepping in much earlier with a view to making up the shortfall?
Well, you get involved with the legal teams from both sides, and it's a very rigid process. We often hear the expression that cases get settled on the steps of the High Court. So there's all the gathering of evidence, there's all the provision of documents.
So was everyone too quick to get into a legal process then back in 2013?
I don't think there was any choice. When it was referred from the High Court to the European Court said that the state was in breach of its obligations, there had to be pension protection, but it didn't go on to define what pension protection would be, what percentage, what level of pension protection should exist. So it then had to come back to the Irish courts for the courts to look at what percentage would be pension protection. In that process, we managed to engage with the government and through the Tánaiste, Joan Burton, get to a stage of being able to refer to the LRC. Most people don't get the opportunity to do this when you're in the court process.
What would be an acceptable settlement then in to resolve this dispute fully?
Well, I suppose the fast answer is 100% of what everybody is entitled
to. What would be a realistic acceptable settlement?
Well, I want to engage in that process with Kieran Mulvey, outline our case, outline exactly what workers are entitled to. We've had the horrible situation that members are actually dying since we started this process. So we'll be outlining exactly what we think we're entitled to, what all the different categories of members with different earnings and different service are entitled to. And we have confidence then in the process that Kieran Mulvey is absolutely committed to reaching an agreed settlement that would be acceptable.
And you hope to be in the Labour Relations Commission when?
We're engaging this week, in fact. Okay. I've been talking to Kieran Mulvey and we're going to start our engagement with the LRC this week.
But the threat of legal action is still there. That hasn't gone away. That's still listed for the High Court.
In January 2015. That's still in place and will happen if there's no resolution in this process.
Okay, we will leave it there. Jimmy Kelly of the Unite Trade Union, thank you for joining us this morning. And the latest research from the Economic and Social Research Institute this morning says that the amount of tax increases and spending cuts in recent years was greatly increased by the decision of successive governments to protect those receiving social welfare. It also says the policy of protecting the less well-off economically has created an outcome where inequality in the distribution of income has actually fallen over the last 5 years. Well, we're joined in studio by research professor with the ESRI, John Fitzgerald. Good morning to you. Give us some idea of the figures you're talking about.
All right. Before the crisis, about 13% of our income went on paying social welfare payments. It rose to a peak of 20% because you had three times as many people unemployed. So the welfare bill to keep a relatively unchanged level of service, although there were some significant cuts.
To protect core social welfare payments, if you like.
Yeah, we had to find an awful lot more money, on top of the fact that we had a massive hole elsewhere in the public finances. So we had to find an awful lot more money. Also, on the tax side, with three times as many people unemployed, they weren't paying tax. And at the top end, you had a dramatic reduction in the numbers of really high earners, which left the rest of the population who are working to pay the taxes.
This is the squeezed middle. So your research is saying that this idea of a squeezed middle does exist. It's calculable. You can say it's there.
Yeah, and our income fell by 8% on average over the whole population from the peak. So a lot of the people who did worst, obviously, were the people who lost their jobs. And then the rest of the population had to take a hit to pay the welfare payments.
What sort of hit did people take? What is the sort of the euro and cent style of figures you're talking about?
Well, for the population as a whole, the average income, including children, has fallen by about 8% from the peak to today.
And the wealthier people, those who would have been on incomes above 100,000, what's happened to their taxes, or what's happened to their disposable income?
If you like? If you take those earning over 275,000, the total income of those people is down 40%. So the numbers are down over 20%, the number of people on really high incomes, and their average income is also down very substantially. And even for those under 100,000, over 100,000, the numbers are down substantially. And of course, the tax rates are up very significantly. So they're paying, the individuals are paying more tax, but there's a lot less of them and their income is lower.
Now, the squeezed middle, if we can call them that, are also people who tend to vote in large numbers at election time. That obviously presents some cause for debate around the forthcoming budget.
And also research done by my colleagues Bertrand Maître and Helen Russell and Chris Whelan show that there are people who are actually on reasonable incomes who are actually in financial distress, who are difficult to pick out. They're not entitled to necessarily welfare payments, but they're the obvious people on mortgages who have major difficulties paying. So it's not just people on low incomes who have problems. There are other people in financial distress as well.
And yet, just to get back to the budget, the number of people on the live register, that is, or the percentage, is falling 14.5% down to around 11% now. What are the opportunities in the forthcoming budget, if you like, to relieve the burden on that squeeze middle, if indeed that's the course government is choosing to take?
There will be a significant saving, because thankfully there'll be quite a lot of people who were unemployed who will get jobs next year. But the thing to remember that each year there are probably 20,000 more retired people. So the pension bill goes up at the same time, just because we're all getting, some of us are getting older.
How out of kilter were we with Europe in terms of that decision to protect social welfare, core social welfare, and cut public spending, raise taxes?
After you take account of welfare payments and taxes, we have a more equitable distribution of income today than before the crisis, whereas in the rest of the EU it got worse. And say Spain or France, there was a particularly big increase in the our reduction in the equity of the distribution of income. But if you take before the tax and welfare system, things got much worse in Ireland because so many people lost their jobs. So the work that the welfare and tax system had to do in order to make a more even distribution of income was much greater, but that's what happened.
If we have lost so many high-earning individuals, or so many people the very highest wages have fallen so dramatically over that 5 years, does that present, it's a controversial enough question I suppose, but does that present any hazards for the economy moving forward?
I'm much more concerned about the trebling of the numbers unemployed. I think those on high incomes will look after themselves.
Right. So they shouldn't expect too much succour in the budget.
No.
And what about the unemployed?
Well, the main thing is to get them employed. And we are seeing a reasonably vigorous growth in employment. So it is prioritising getting people back to work, because A, that makes them significantly better off, and B, it reduces the welfare bill. That's where there's a win-win.
Okay, we'll leave it there. John Fitzgerald of the ESRI, thank you very much for joining us in studio this morning.
The largest known private collection of memorabilia charting the history of the Troubles is being offered free to a good home. London-based architect Peter Maloney has built up a collection of more than 40,000 posters, badges, images, books, political journals and leaflets. And Peter joins us now from the BBC's Foyle studio in Derry. Good morning.
Good morning.
It sounds like quite an extraordinary collection. Will you tell us a little bit about it? How did you come to start collecting these items?
I got involved in doing lectures about the north of Ireland when I was in London. And it was very difficult in the early days to find sufficient images to illustrate those lectures. And I found that the posters and the slogans and the leaflets were often a very good source for making images to illustrate lectures. And that was really the start of the collection.
And what sort of items do you have?
It's very broad ranging. Like, there's over 11,000 photographs of slogans and wall murals, down to things like bus tickets, biros with political slogans on them, coins that have been overstamped, even stamps themselves, illegal Republican stamps that would happen around the Christmas period.
So why have you decided then that the time is right for all of these items to go to another home?
I don't have the capacity to preserve any of these items, and some of them are very ancient. They're dating back to the 1880s, some of them. I can't preserve them. They need looking after, they need protecting, because they are part of our common history and deserve to be recognised.
By the sounds of things then, if you decided to sell some of these items, you might get a good price.
Some of them are very valuable. I have one postcard that I was offered £50 for 30 years ago of hunger strikers in County Tipperary in 1920. Probably a unique item. Yes, it would be very valuable, but I think socially it has a greater intrinsic value for the people in the north of Ireland.
Ideally, what would you like to become of all of these?
I would like it to be a resource that people can use as part of a peace and reconciliation process, because it does graphically illustrate some of the horrors of our recent history, a history that we should not have to repeat.
And I suppose for younger people in particular, who may not remember the events of even 15 or 20 years ago, a lot of this stuff would be fascinating and also very important.
I think it is intrinsically important, because it is very easy to take sides in looking back at our history with only seeing one side and not the other. And we do need to see both sides of the argument to make a comprehensive judgment of it.
Have you had any expressions of interest so far?
Well, parts of the collection are in the Museum of Free Derry. There is some in a Healing Through Remembering exhibition currently on in Belfast at the moment. The Victoria and Albert Museum want to borrow some pieces for a touring exhibition happening next year.
Ideally, though, would you like the bulk of the items to remain together?
I think it should remain together, because it's quite a comprehensive study of what went on here. And the broader the perspective you get, the better an understanding you would have of what went on.
Mm. If any particular institution is interested, what should they do?
Contact me. There is a website on the Kane internet site set up by University of Ulster. They contact me through that.
All right. Well, listen, many thanks for joining us on the programme this morning and the very best of luck with it. That was Peter Maloney there joining us from the BBC studio in Derry. Brian Finn is here with the business.
Rachel, thank you. Ryanair says it's going to pay out a special dividend of 520 million euro or 37.5 cent per share in the fourth quarter, pending shareholder approval. The airline says it's on course for higher full-year profits than previously guided. It reported first quarter results this morning to the end of June. Howard Miller is Ryanair's Deputy CEO and Chief Financial Officer.
Well, it was a very strong quarter. Average fare rose by 9%. About half of that is due to a very strong Easter period, half due to underlying performance. Overall, you know, profits rose by 152% to 197 million euros.
A fairly strong performance, albeit, as you mentioned, with Easter falling in the quarter this year, which it didn't last year. But what's your outlook for the rest of the year, especially the busy summer season?
Yeah, we expect that the underlying trend in terms of average fare will continue into Q2 to the end of September. However, in the winter, we expect that fares will fall by between 6 and 8% as we significantly increase capacity on key business routes. But overall for the year, average fare to rise by 2% and profits to grow by over 20%. To something between 620 and 650 million euros.
You reported your first fall in profits in 5 years last year, but you said you were confident of returning to profit growth this year, as you've outlined there. Is your more customer-focused strategy paying off in this regard?
Well, it's certainly contributing towards the success of the business. You know, the improvements to the website, the launch of allocated seating, and the other significant changes we've done, including recently launching the mobile app, are all a contributing factor to the improvement in the business.
You've mentioned in the past as well that you're on course to offer some kind of business travel option. Is that something that might come on stream in the coming months?
Yeah, we expect to have that launched in early September. We think this will be very, very attractive for our business passengers. We're also realigning our schedules to make them more business-friendly across this winter period, and we think it'll be a tremendous success.
Will that involve separate sections of the plane where business travellers will be sitting?
No, we won't have a cordoned-off area of the aircraft for business travellers, but they will get access to premium seats, many of which are either up the front of the aircraft or indeed at the overwing exits where there's much extra legroom.
You were due to start flights to Russia earlier this year. It hasn't happened yet. Is that something that's still on the agenda, or are you reviewing that?
Well, it was something we were looking at, and we would hope to have that in position. There's a lot of things obviously associated with the Russian market, and following recent developments in the Ukraine, things are a bit more difficult. But it's something we're looking at, and it may be something we launch either this winter or next spring.
Other routes that have been mentioned in the past are routes to Israel or even the US at some point. Is there any news or developments in that regard?
No, I mean, long haul is something we've talked about, but we don't have the equipment really to do long haul routes, where our primary focus will continue to be on short haul routes within the European market.
The European Commission ordered Ryanair to pay back nearly 10 million in state aid from the French government just a few days ago. Are there likely to be more of these rulings from other countries or within France?
We had 24 cases in total, investigations. Of those 24, we've had rulings on 10. We've won 7 and lost 3. And we would expect to win most of these cases. Indeed, we're appealing those 3 cases that we lost. And we have a very, very strong economic background. And we think that we'll be successful upon appeal.
It's been a tumultuous few weeks for the airline industry, with 3 airliners crashing in this very short space of time. Do events like that have a negative impact on the industry worldwide, and would you see it in Ryanair?
Well, they were largely two long-haul incidents. We don't fly long-haul. We only fly short-haul within Europe. Europe is very highly regulated in terms of aircraft safety in particular. So we haven't seen any impact on our business.
Just on the Aer Lingus situation, you were ordered to reduce your shareholding there to 5% by the British Competition Commission. Where does that stand now?
Well, we're going through an appeal process. That appeal process has probably about another year or so to run. We're also going through the original appeal or the appeal of the decision of the European Commission as well. So this process, unfortunately, will go on for some time, and the final outcome will certainly be not for at least 18 to 24 months.
That's the outgoing Deputy Chief Executive of Ryanair, Howard Miller, who's staying with the airline as a board member. The central bank is proposing to allow hedge funds based here to lend to companies under new rules being drawn up. Firms that are not getting access to bank funding or that are too small to issue bonds are increasingly seeking to borrow from other sources such as insurers, private equity firms and hedge funds. The central bank has issued a consultation paper on its proposed rules today and expects them to be in place by the end of the year. Just finally, a look at the currencies this morning. The euro is trading at just above $1.34 and 79 pence sterling.
Brian, thank you very much. An autumnal feel in the weather in Dublin this morning. What's it like elsewhere in the country? Well, it's over to Joanna Donnelly at Met Éireann.
Thank you. A very good morning. Yeah, Dublin is quite cold and misty. It's the mist will drag the temperature down and make you feel cooler, all right. It's going to be a cloudy start for a lot of the country with some outbreaks of rain over mainly over the eastern parts. But it's going to become mainly dry with spells of sunshine developing widely, though, as the day goes on. Temperatures today between 18 and 21 degrees. It's around normal for the time of year. And there's a moderate northwest wind that's going to ease as the day goes on too. It'll back westerly this evening. Then tonight there's going to be a bit of an ingress from the Atlantic again. Some more increasing cloud in the northwest will bring outbreaks of rain there, and that's going to push then across the rest of the country overnight tonight. Temperatures overnight about 13 or 14 degrees and those light westerly winds. So as a consequence then, Tuesday's going to start dull and damp as well with patchy rain and drizzle. But again, it'll become dry and bright with sunny spells. Just a few isolated showers as the day goes on. Temperatures tomorrow still around normal for the time of year, around 18 to 21 degrees. And again, a moderate northwest wind. Then Tuesday night, there'll be clear spells developing, although you'll see some rain linger along the northwest coast. Most places will be dry. Temperatures around 11 to 13 degrees. Wednesday, mainly dry and bright with sunny spells. Just occasional showers. Temperatures around normal for the time of year. Thursday will be a wetter day. There'll be a bit more in the way of heavy showers around on Thursday. And Friday at the moment is looking still unsettled with some rain or showers around too. Indications suggest the weekend unsettled as well. But in the meantime, it should brighten up today. 18 to 21 degrees. That's the forecast. Good morning.